In this third sermon in our series, Unafraid, based on Adam Hamilton's book, we turn to some introspective fears. How about the whole title of the book, Unafraid, Living with Courage and Hope in Uncertain Times? Right. This week, we turn to some introspective kinds of fears, fear of failure, the need to please others, the fear of insignificance, and the fear of loneliness. All of these are real fears, and we all encounter them one on one level or another. We all want to be successful in the things that we are doing, no matter how we define success. It is something we have to reach for, something we have to stretch a bit to attain, and something that to some degree can be affected by the opinion of others. Pleasing the people in our lives is also something that most of us strive for and toward. In some ways, it is linked to our sense of success or failure. Pleasing people always comes with evaluation and criticism from those we are seeking to please. Pleasing others is not only dependent upon our success, but on the disposition of those we are seeking to please. No matter how successful we think we might be, others might have a different idea. It's tricky. I don't know how many of you, I don't know how many other people you know, but seeking to be successful on your own and seeking to please others at the same time is a tall mountain to climb, a mountain that we choose to climb every day. At the end of the day, we all seek significance and engagement with others in our lives. That's what we're built to do. There's a degree of fear in all of us that is linked to having and making meaning in our lives, and that meaning is found in our relationships with God and with each other. Bottom line. It's just a quote that I read from a preacher. I don't even know who said it. If one thing I say positively affects one person, I will count my effort a success. If one thing I say today positively affects one person in this room, I will count my effort a success. Probably written by someone who had a people-pleasing complex, right? You're off the hook if only one, you're like 100 people in the room, only one of you have to agree with or get something positive out of one thing I say and I'm done. Check the box, right? There's good and bad in that statement, but there's clearly insecurity expressed in that quote, right? I find great comfort in it. The art of preaching is all about pleasing and challenging others. I think everything I write is good. Before I get here, I think it's great. But I don't enter this endeavor alone. You are here with me. It's interactive. How you receive what I say has an impact on whether or not I'm successful. Preaching, as I said, is not an individual endeavor. There are a few things in life that are individual endeavors, actually. Success is generally not measured in isolation. It'd be a lot easier that way, wouldn't it? Fear of failure is something that we all face, something we all must manage. When our fear of failure begins limiting what we are willing to try, that is when it becomes a problem in our lives. Before we get there, grab this blue thing in your bulletins because we'll need it today through the service. Right? The fear of failure becomes a problem when it stops us from trying the next thing or doing the thing God is calling us to do next. My mom had this famous quote that I am sure that her mom used before her and her mom before her and so on and so on. I think it's as old as time. But she used to say, if one of us kids would say, "Mom, I can't," she would say, "Can't never did anything. Right? Can't never got out of the chair. How do you know you can't if you don't try?" Right? Can't never did anything. And it just echoes in my head. Trying hardly ever resulted in complete failure. Sure, depending on what it was I was trying for the first time, I was met with differing degrees of success, but not trying always produces the same result. Failure to move, failure to try something always produces the same result. Nothing. Can't, never did anything, my mom used to say. My family moved, and we changed school districts when I was in the fifth grade. And so I didn't start playing the trumpet until the sixth grade, and my classmates all started in the fifth grade, so that they had that summer between elementary and middle school to practice, right? To kind of get familiar with their instruments and to learn some things. But I didn't start till the beginning of sixth grade. And then in April of my sixth grade year, we moved from Portland, Michigan to Los Angeles, California. And those kids started and got their instruments at the end of fourth grade, so they were ready for fifth grade band. So I find myself really far behind. That first spring that I was in Torrance, California, my middle school band director, Mr. Davidson, he just died this last year, really good guy. Anyway, he challenged me to play a solo at the spring concert that first year. He asked me to play the Star-Spangled Banner on my trumpet to open the concert that first year. I was terrified. Right. I don't know how you've sung the national anthem, but it's not much easier to play on the trumpet than it is to sing. It's hard. It's got a wide range. Right. And I worked my tail off. And to be honest, I have no idea how it went. I just know that I lived through it. Right? I tried it. I found the courage to do it. And it was at least as good as Roseanne Barr in the Padres game in 2009. Right? Anybody remember that? Yeah. Probably not. It wasn't Kate Smith for sure. Right? But trying resulted in some degree of success because, you know what? By the end of my seventh grade year, I was second chair. Right? I was first or second chair all the way through high school, majored in music at Michigan State. I caught up. I surpassed many of the people that I was playing with because I was willing to take the risk. Adam Hamilton offers three principles that can help us deal with our fear of failure, and they're in your handout. The first one, most things are never as hard as you fear they will be. Right? I say this especially if there's much time between when you begin contemplating this thing and the thing actually happens. The more time that there is in there, the more time there is for us to imagine how horrible it will be. And don't we tend to do that? Make up the worst case scenario, right? The second one is successful people are willing to do the things that unsuccessful people are unwilling to do. How many of you find yourselves in a conference room at work or in a meeting room at church or somewhere around in a group of people and something needed to be done and you can hear the crickets in the room? I need a volunteer too. And everything just falls silent. And then you feel more or less compelled to say, well, I can do that. I can give it a try, right? Often it's the person who is willing to do the things that, or successful people are willing to do the things that unsuccessful people are unwilling to do, right? Suck it up, buttercup, just do it. It'll be fine, right? And three, more often than not, choosing the harder, riskier, inconvenient path is the right choice. If we consistently choose the path of least resistance in our life, we will consistently fall short of what we're capable of. This is the truth. Generally, not the right, maybe the easiest way to go, but not the right way to go most often. And the last of these three principles Hamilton calls discernment by nausea. He says that if the decision you are making or the risk you are taking doesn't make you just a little bit nauseous, you probably aren't stretching far enough. Right? You may recall me talking about this in terms of the merger process at the point that we all voted to move forward. We were together here in this room in April. And all three churches put together, and it was an overwhelming positive vote. And I was just a little bit nauseous because I knew the work that was ahead of us, and I knew how difficult it would be. And here we are on the other side of that, 6 months, And it wasn't that painful at all. Sure, we had some things we bumped into. We have some things we're still trying to iron out. And we have a building to sell. We have all sorts of stuff that we're still facing. But guess what? This has all gone swimmingly. I just appreciate all of the work that went into that. Scripturally, Adam Hamilton uses one of my favorite verses to support this idea of trying things. He kind of turns this verse for me. I hadn't thought of it in these terms, and so it's eye-opening for me. Romans 8:28 is a verse that I often use when facing difficult situations. And we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose for them. When we're facing challenges and health challenges and crises in our life, it's important to remember that verse, that somewhere, somehow, God is working good in this situation, even as awful as it is in the moment. And as brothers and sisters in Christ walking alongside someone who's in the midst of a crisis, it's often our job to look for the good that God is doing, because the people in the midst of it just can't see it. So we hold one another up by looking for the good that God is doing and by testifying, by holding on to hope for folks that for their crisis can't see it. They'll come. Applied as Adam Hamilton uses this verse, though, expecting good in all things allows us to move forward into the most challenging prospects, knowing that God will work for good regardless of our perceived success or failure. Think of how much easier it is to try things that you're unsure of if you know that God works in all things for the good of those who love him and live according to his will. Think how much easier it is to step out on faith if you know that God is going to work for good in what, no matter how miserably you fail. God will work for good in whatever it is that we give him. God will bless our efforts even if we screw it up royally. God will bless our efforts by doing good in the midst of our mess-ups. I had never thought of that verse that way, but I am empowered. Look out. Things might get messy. But I trust God will work for good if I'm faithful in my effort. My favorite illustration that Hamilton uses to help us understand success and failure comes in his description of the failures in a commercial Michael Jordan made in 1997 called, I think it's called Failure. He was advertising for Air Jordan 12s. And Michael is walking down a corridor, and you hear him saying things on slide one. This is a quote from the commercial. I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. Michael Jordan, arguably the best basketball player to ever lace up sneakers. Right? I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I failed over and over and over again in my life, and that is why I succeed. Failure is an important part of every success. Wayne Gretzky, the most prolific goal scorer in NHL history, is quoted as saying, "You miss 100% of the shots you don't take." Right? The best hockey player, the most prolific offensive hockey player ever, says you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. While these are only sports analogies, they cross over into every aspect of human life. Edison failed hundreds of times before electric light was successful. Many people died and still die as surgeons work to perfect organ transplants and other life-saving procedures. We cannot move forward without failure, and we cannot experience success unless we're willing to try. But we're afraid to fail. Doesn't compute, really. God gives us courage. Jesus himself was rejected, scorned, abused, and eventually killed. His ministry, if measured in terms of his effort to reform Judaism, was not successful until you examine the Christian movement as an extension of that effort over its 2,000 years of history. Our being here today is a testament to Christ's success, and every Christian that comes after us and continues the ministry that Christ started in the world is an additional testament to Christ's work. The issue with Christ's ministry is that Christ has charged people with continuing it, and that will necessarily result in a number of failures on our way to any success. We sometimes raise the bar for church folks, right? Well, they're church folks. They shouldn't act like that. Hooey. It's nonsense. We are nothing more than a bunch of broken people here to find healing and wholeness and grace in Christ. And anyone who expects anything else doesn't really understand what church is. And if you're sitting here in the church and you're offended because something happened to you here in this building that you shouldn't think have gone that way because, by goodness, you were in church, hooey. It just means that one broken person bumped into another broken person. Sorry about it. Grace. We don't succeed all the time in being graceful people. Grace covers that too. Being people are wired to be in relationship with people, we are concerned about what other people think of us. That's how it works. As I age and mature, I care less about what people think of me, but I still care. I'm more confident about who I am and who God's called me to be than I used to be, so I'm a little less frail, but I still care about what other people think of me. When we fail, or when the choices that we make are perceived as failure, what others think and say about our failures matters to us. It's called criticism. A certain amount and kind of criticism is good. Proverbs 27:17 says, "As iron sharpens iron, so people sharpen people." If anyone has ever learned to sharpen a blade on a knife or anything else, you know that it is delicate work and that when not done carefully, does not produce a sharper edge. We could ruin a knife in a hurry if you don't sharpen it carefully. God uses the people in our lives to help keep us in check, to give us a system of checks and balances. When our friends and family ask about the decisions we are making and point us toward God and toward productive or corrective end, that is a good thing. It sharpens us. It makes us better. It makes us stronger. And that kind of criticism is called constructive criticism. Constructive criticism is most often still negative, at least on the front end of it, and therefore difficult to give and to hear. But this kind of criticism is still necessary in our lives because we are human. And as human beings, we don't always get everything right, even when we think we're always right. Maybe especially when we think we're always right. We need people in our lives to give us constructive criticism, to help us become better, stronger, sharper. We don't do life very well on our own. Then there is the other form of criticism, the kind that even when given with good intention, only serves to break down and cause pain. Criticizing someone for the sake of being critical or without taking care in doing so is destructive and causes pain and fracture in relationships. Adam Hamilton spends most of chapter 10 of his book describing this kind of criticism as it relates to social media. I know not all of you use social media, but in its place in our culture is strong, and I don't see it going anywhere soon. Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, and the like give us access to one another instantly and constantly. On social media, we can say anything we want, anytime we want, without directly dealing with the person or people we are criticizing. It's a dangerous space. Distance insulates us from the impact of our critical words. We can get away with it because we don't know how it makes someone feel. There's time between what we slam on the page and rebuttal, a return. Adam Hamilton gives this section of his book the heading Instant, Anonymous, and Nasty. We can also be critical of ourselves in unhelpful ways. Remember, because we are human beings designed to be in relationship with other human beings, we care about what others think of us. And the other aspect of social media that we lose without direct communication and or extended dialogue is the ability to clearly understand both the content and the intent of what is being said or offered. My first semester in seminary, my professor, I was taking Christian education and ministry, and my professor said, I will not enter difficult dialogue with you electronically. If you want to talk to me about something, come and talk to me. He said, but statistics show that 80% of all written communication is misinterpreted in some way. I'm not giving you license to misinterpret what I say to you. I want to talk to you. I feel the same way. If you have an issue or a problem something you want to discuss with me, I'm glad to sit down. I don't care what it is. I'm glad to sit down and discuss it with you. I will not engage you on social media or email platforms when the rubber meets the road. It won't do either of us any good. When we either are too quick to be critical of what we are posting, or are too quick to interpret that which someone else has posted, we don't have the opportunity to clearly understand one another. And we do damage. We hurt each other's feelings. We sometimes make decisions about what is being said to us, in this case, that are too critical of the person doing the posting. We receive the post negatively and decide we are being harshly criticized without really knowing, and then we allow our relationships to be damaged in the process. I guess they're mad at me. That's all caps. They must be yelling at me. Really? Sometimes I can hit all caps on my phone and not really pay attention. I'm not going to yell at you on social media or in a text message. So don't interpret it that way. You get to, but it's a choice. Hamilton offers a scriptural approach to posting and to interpreting social media. When a few simple, easily understood rules that have been around for a long time for communication are applied, some of the destructive dangers of virtual communication are mitigated. These rules appear in your sermon guide for this week, the bottom on the front page, rules for engaging others in person or in social media. Rules for engaging others. You should treat people the same way you want them to treat you. You should treat others the same way you want them to treat you. Golden rule. It's pretty simple. You probably heard this when you were 4 or 5, right? I learned it the hard way. I had an older brother. So if I punched him, I always got one back. I learned to treat people the same way I wanted to be treated. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Emphasis added by me. Loving our neighbors, we can understand that. But in this era of people-pleasing and trying to, we're sometimes really hard on ourselves. I think our inability to love ourselves limits our ability to love others. You hear that? You can only reciprocate that which you know about yourself. If you have a low self-image or self-esteem, you're handcuffed to love others. You're limited. We have to see ourselves as Lauren Daigle said in the song. We need to believe what God believes about us. Then our capacity to love is matched. It's limitless. And the third one, be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to grow angry, James 1:19. Of all of the valuable ways to approach communication, I think this advice from James is the most valuable, whether communicating on social media or otherwise. Using this approach, we allow ourselves the opportunity for more than one interpretation of what we read or hear, and the opportunity to respond more carefully and more gracefully. I follow Bob Goff, the author of Love Does and Everybody Always on Twitter. See, social media again. Slide 2 reveals a quote that I came across this week that he posted on Twitter, and it goes like this. Fear only has as much power as we give it. Hope works the same. What are you giving more power in your life, fear or hope? Fear or grace? The fear of failing to please others has only the power we give it. There is an especially powerful quote. I mean, this is especially powerful quote when applied to social media. When you're reading something in social media, you get to make a choice about what it says to you. What are you giving more power? Fear or grace? Fear or hope? Right? Jesus demonstrated all that we are describing here in an important concept called grace. Slide number 3. Right? This covers really all of it. If you are hearing gracefully, you are more likely to interpret gracefully. If you are reading gracefully, you are more likely to interpret gracefully. If you are writing gracefully or speaking gracefully, you are more likely to be graceful in your communications. I challenge you all to seek to be more graceful in communication of all forms and to see how it affects your relationships with others. Another form of fear that Adam Hamilton addresses in this section of the book is a fear of meaninglessness. In doing so, he talks about the number of suicides that he has dealt with in just 3 months leading up to his writing. He said that 10 people had taken their own lives in a very short time, some who were members of the congregation and others who were friends or relatives of congregants. 10 suicides in 3 months. And keep in mind, there are 22,000 members at the church that he's serving, so the scale is a little different than here, but 10 suicides is a lot. Suicide happens in utter isolation and utter loneliness. I am convinced that when someone takes their own life, the only person in the room is them. The only person they can think of is themselves. Whether it be emotional or mental illness or some other thing, they are become so isolated that they can't think of the impact that the action they're going to take has on other people. Isolation and loneliness and meaninglessness are dangerous for human beings. We are not wired for those things. We all know someone who has had to deal with suicide. It's a very difficult and challenging issue. Hamilton said of these people, all were persons who struggled with depression or who lost a sense that life mattered. He describes the search for meaning as a fundamental human need. We need to know that there's a purpose for our being here. A number of young people make the decision to end their lives because of what they have read in social media in their direction. Because someone who was too immature to manage what they were saying or typing did damage that they could not reverse. We all know young people who are working in the realm of social media all the time, who are building relationship there all the time. We have an obligation to help them understand the implications of what they are doing. Finding meaning and the things from which we draw meaning over the course of our lives changes, right? Meaninglessness comes, I think, when something shifts, something we once drew meaning from goes away. When I was a kid, I didn't think much about meaning in life. Some kids do, and Some kids suffer from depression and things like that, so I don't mean to speak for all. But even as a teenager, I had friends, I did my thing. I was pretty easy come, easy go. I got married when I was about 22. I was almost 23. And then, now I'm someone's husband. Meaning for me in that, I have someone to care for and someone to care for me directly. Then we had a couple of kids, and so I'm now a provider and a father and a role model for my children. All the while, I'm a son and brother and grandson and all other ways that I'm connected with people. But do you see how all of those things that bring meaning are connections with other human beings? At least in my life. Now, we also draw meaning from what we do in our lives, from our work. I haven't always been a pastor. At some point in my life, I was a musician, and I chased that real hard. And when that didn't work out, I had to shift gears and draw meaning from other kinds of work, kind of pointless, meaningless work. But when done the way that God has called me to do it, to use all of my gifts and faculties to do the best that I could, I can draw meaning even from putting stickers on boxes of dog food being shipped to people everywhere in the country. By hour, like click, click. We draw meaning from our work, and now I'm a pastor, and I think a lot about being a pastor. But let's think about those relationships again, right? Let's say that something happened to my wife or my kids, like it would be devastating and horrible and heartbreaking, and I would have to find new ways to draw meaning in my life in the midst of the crisis. Work changes. I haven't always been a pastor. I was a distribution coordinator at one point in my career, and that work went away in a downsizing, and I had to find some other way to find meaning. We have to be able to disengage and re-engage in the things that from which we draw meaning. Employment is conditional. If we drew all of our meaning from our work and our work changes, we can also lose sight of our sense of meaning in the world. Additionally, our work affords us the ability to acquire things. Some of us draw meaning from the stuff that we have, from the nice house or the nice car that we drive, or from our clothing or our ability to save for our retirement and for what we might hand down to our kids. We draw meaning from our portfolio. And we all know that that is conditional, that shifts and changes. Right? And unless we find ways to draw meaning in another way, we can lose track of our sense of worth. We have to remember that we are created by God for a purpose. We are created to give and receive love. We are created to be in relationship with God and with others. The basis of our meaning comes from our relationship with God and others. Hamilton offers us a way to be reminded of the meaning of our lives through something he calls the upside-down way of Jesus, the backside of your blue sheet, right? In this section of the book, he offers two scriptures, the first of them in Luke chapter 9. These are fill-ins, so I'm going to read them for you. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit their very self? What good is it for us to pour ourselves so much into what we can acquire, what we can gain, what we can save for our kids, that we lose ourselves in the process? None. No good. Well, almost no good. Because what happened in 1931 or so, when the stock market took a plummet and everything everyone had accumulated just went away? If your whole self-worth was wrapped up in that, guess what? Tomorrow's a different day. But if in that crisis your identity, your who you are, is wrapped up in who God sees you as, you're all right. And you start over, right? when people come to me who are seeking meaning, seeking to find essence, and they're desperate to find meaning and purpose in their lives, especially when they're between jobs. Let's say they lost their job and they're looking for work. Often I will say to them, What gifts do you have that you can use in volunteer work? Where can you plug in somewhere and use the gifts that God has given you to do good? And they'll say, well, I don't have time for that. I want to find a job. I'm like, well, you don't have time not to do that, because we draw meaning from using what God has given us. Right? Saint Francis of Assisi says, it is in giving that we receive. Right? It is in giving that we receive. And I apologize now for the length of this message. I am going to keep going because we have two more things to cover, and I know that it's painful. If you need to get up and stretch your legs or whatever, you do your thing. But the most challenging part of this sermon series has been trying to condense four really solid chapters of material into one message. So here we go. Almost all of what we've been talking about today has to do with relationship. Since we are made to love and to be loved, we need to be in relationship with God and with one another. The last fear that Hamilton presents in his book is the fear of loneliness. All of us fear being alone to some degree. I talked earlier about drawing meaning from being a husband and a father. If something happened to my wife, I would have to figure out another way. I have to understand that my meaningfulness comes from God, and that while I am deeply in love with my wife, I am still worth something without her. It'd take a minute, I can tell you. Right. Eventually, the cure for loneliness is engagement with other people. Isolation and insulation are not the cure for loneliness. If you know someone who's lonely and they continue to withdraw, go get them. Go reach out to them and tell them that you love them and you care about them and they are worth something to you. God's first not good, as Hamilton explains it, is loneliness. He creates humankind in the garden, he raises Adam from the dust of the earth, and he says, this is good. And in a minute, he says, it is not good for humankind to be alone. And he makes a helpmate. He makes someone to connect life with. Our meaning comes from being in relationship with God and with one another. A number of you are in a season of life where you find yourselves living alone. Your children have grown, your marriage has ended either by death or divorce, or perhaps you have never been married and the friends you have had throughout your life are beginning to reach life's end. Our circumstances, though they may have changed, don't change our need to be connected. We are designed to need connection with others in our lives. Do not withdraw. Do not seclude yourself. Think about the tremendous blessing you have by being in community in this place with other people on this day. It is so important. In relationship with God, we are already loved. Love others as we love ourselves. One of the best messages I have ever heard on Christian life, it talks about three people: Paul, Barnabas, and Timothy. I stand him like this. Paul poured his life into Timothy. He was a mentor. Timothy was mentored by Paul and received Paul's blessing. Barnabas was a friend that walked with Paul. In this message, the pastor said that we all need to be in all three of those kinds of relationships all the time in our lives. We have to be pouring our lives into someone else. We have to have someone who's mentoring us and pouring their lives into us. And we have to have colleagues, folks to walk alongside in our lives. If you're doing all three of those things, you can't be isolated and lonely, right? You will find purpose in doing those things in your life. I asked to have slide number 4 appear on the screen. Well, we'll get there in just a second. The fear of loneliness. I'm going to just ask you a couple of questions there. You can read those by yourselves. Our acronym for FEAR gives us steps to combat all of this introspective fear that we face this week. Face your fears with faith. Understand that God loves you just the way you are and created you for a purpose. Examine your assumptions in light of the facts. Think about what you're reading and writing in social media. Give it time to discern what's really there. Attack your anxieties with action. Don't isolate yourself. Get out of your shell. Go do something. Connect with people. Give your gifts and release your cares to God. All important ways to combat this kind of fear. Our spiritual practice this week is practicing God's presence. There are instructions in your handout this week about how to do that. It's pretty simple, right? Understand that God is with you always. God's presence is a term called omnipresence. God is present everywhere at the same time, all the time. You can't be alone. Search the scriptures for reminders of God's presence. Make a list, either mentally or written down, of the ways that God's shown up in your life and count him to show up again, and breathe in the presence of God and breathe out the fear of loneliness, and rejection, and disappointment. It will work. Practices are there in front of you. Are we going to do the closing song? Are we doing another song? Are we just going to wrap this right here? All right. Do you want to sing again? We want to sing again. Bring it on up. All right. But I will give a benediction right here so that when the song is over, we can just go. You can go now if the song is not your game, right? We've kept you a long time today, but there's so much content, and it's so important to understand. So important to understand. So bless you all. Go in peace when you go. Know you are loved and that you are important to someone and there are people that are important to you. Go in peace, carrying God's peace with you. Amen.